CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Prem Kaur and Kaylee Alig will be telling us a little bit about cavernous malformations. Can you tell me about the Angioma Alliance?
Well, what I can tell you is, so we're Angioma Alliance Canada, so we are committed to connecting, forming, advocating for, and supporting people in Canada who are affected by cavernous malformation, and we also support their family and friends. We also work with researchers and medical professionals in Canada in order to raise awareness of the disease and towards the search for a cure.
So for those who might not be as familiar, how do these conditions typically affect a person?
So people that have a cavernous malformation, which is a rare disease, which has been defined by the National Organization for Rare Diseases, affects about 0.2% of the general population, and about 1 in 500 people will have one cavernous malformation. The most popular area for cavernous malformation to present is in the brain. A more rare place is in the spinal cord. And what we know is that about 50% of the people who have symptoms have a seizure. Other times it can present as focal neurological deficits, including like blurred vision or weakness in limbs, or it can result in a hemorrhage, which is the most feared result, but is not as common as some of the other symptoms to take place. And about 20 to 50% of patients who have a cavernous malformation have no symptoms.
So that being said, the host of potential symptoms, is there ever a risk of misdiagnosis?
So there is times when perhaps it could be diagnosed as something else. And going back a long time ago, of course, before we had the wonderful invention of the MRI and the ability for people to have access to MRIs in many different centers, including those that are rural, you know, the diagnosis was somewhat tricky because we didn't have imaging in order to help us. So back in those days, there was instances of people perhaps being diagnosed with other type of, you know, neurological disorders or other types of reasons that may cause symptomology, such as seizures, or perhaps they were diagnosed with epilepsy only at the time, not really knowing the background cause of it. Thankfully, in recent years, we have had the ability to use imaging to assist clinicians in making those diagnoses. And on top of that, we do know that there is people who have it, a genetic version of cavernous malformation. And in those cases, people are able to have a genetic test that identifies one of three gene mutations that can cause the genetic form of the disease. So that happens in about 20% of the cases of people with the cavernous malformation. About 20% of those cases are the result of a genetic disease has taken place.
So when you say it's a rare condition, you know offhand about how many people are affected by cavernous malformations?
So the data we have does come from the National Organization for Rare Disorders, and actually Rare Disease Today is coming up February 29th, which is an opportunity for us to raise awareness about cavernous malformation being one of those rare diseases. And the statistics that we have are about 0.2% of the population would have cavernous malformation. And that kind of translates to about 1 in 500 people may have one of a cavernous malformation. And people who have one generally fall in the group that is not the familial or genetic type. People with a genetic type of the disease most often have more than one of a cavernous malformation. And just kind of being really clear on what exactly is a cavernous malformation, it's like a mulberry-like shape, abnormal grouping of blood vessels, these smaller blood vessels that are called capillaries, that have thin, leaky walls. And so sometimes those leaky walls can allow blood into brain or spinal tissue, depending where the cavernous malformation is. And it's important to understand that the blood that flows through a cavernous malformation is like a slow-moving blood. So it's not a fast-moving blood that you might see in an aneurysm, for instance. It's a slow...
How does the Alliance reach out to those potentially affected?
So we have... We're expanding sort of our outreach currently, and it's interesting, so thank you so much for that question. So we have social media sites and a website that allows us to interact with people who are affected by the disease, to provide peer support to them, to give them the most recent information that helps them in their journey of living with this disease for which there is no cure. We also are able to utilize some of the research and clinical trials that have given us some information, also expert opinions, which kind of is really important as we wait for some of the research and clinical trials to conclude their investigations, to help them be as safe as possible so that they don't have the most serious outcomes of the disease, such as intracranial hemorrhage, which is always the most feared outcome of the disease. Also, we also work with, we have a scientific clinical advisory board that we work with that gives us information that will help patients that we can go to for questions and who work on a lot of our scientific and clinical information that we are able to give to patients to operate in their day-to-day. And I'm also going to ask Kaylee a little bit what she feels like could be some pieces on how we support our membership.
Yeah, the Facebook group has been a good connection, connecting other Canadian patients together. The American one is quite large, and there are a little more resources, but most are American. So having the connection to a Canadian group where maybe other patients can connect if they're local and just share what has worked for them, or if there's resources in their town, or if they have an idea of a doctor who's familiar with this. Sometimes these things can be shared. So there's good support that's maybe more local or at least Canadian. And, we can kind of understanding the healthcare system and different things like that, or how to utilize other things as well. So it helps kind of navigate our diagnosis and our disease and that journey that we'll have to go through once we're first diagnosed.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And also, we do connect with patients and caregivers. People who have expertise, even if it's not in their own area, we're able to connect them, assist them with referrals. We go through helping them with different things they may face in their journey if they have a surgical intervention, or they have other things in their life related to their work or their lifestyle. We assist them with finding some help and strategies to get through those things. We have support groups that we hold as well, and information sessions. And we also invite experts to come and do questions and answers with patients and their families, because with this being a rare disease too, it is a challenge sometimes, depending where people live, to find those experts that can really help them with the type of information they would have, because they see a high number of patients with cavernous malformation while we wait for the very long, at times, procedures of research and clinical trials, which are critically important but do take time.
So each of you could send any message to the community about the need to keep pushing forward and supports. What would you say?
Well, I think it's really important that there's an understanding of this. Because depending on where it is in your brain or your spinal cord, the symptoms can be so different. And kind of having a bit of an understanding of this, it can help speed up the diagnosis. And also it contributes to the research, because, 1 in 500 people have this or have symptoms, and we know how to treat them versus doing a lot of testing and trying to figure out all these things when you don't really know what's going on. So I think if there's just even just a little bit of understanding that, you know, this can affect your brain or your spinal cord, and maybe it's this versus, you know, you have these symptoms you likely have of this, because sometimes it does take quite a while to get a diagnosis because it presents presents quite similarly to many other diagnoses as well. So I think it's good to have this on people's radars and to have just an understanding about it. It's important.
I totally agree. And I think one thing too is to remember that this can happen at any stage of life, meaning infancy and childhood. And also, like, I think it's really important for anyone out there that may be facing a diagnosis of cavernous malformation, which can also be known sometimes as a cavernoma and can also be known sometimes as a cavernous angioma, that you're not alone. We're here at Angiolimits Canada to support you and to help you through the stages that you may be going through and what you're facing. It's really scary. Well, I mean, I am also a patient of cavernous malformation, a person affected by the disease, and it's very scary to find out that you have something in your spinal cord or brain, even though this is benign condition. There is no current cure for it, and except the only thing that can be done sometimes is a surgical intervention. But sometimes people have cavernous malformations that are not operable due to the location that they're at, they're in their brain or spinal cord. So just we wish really want people to know they're not alone, and you know there's people who understand what they're going through and are committed to helping them through those steps in their life as they navigate that.
Right. Thank you both for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
In this segment of our show, Tom Jones will be telling us a little bit about his disability ministry. So, what can you tell me about your disability and ministry work?
Well, right now I'm with the Faith Inclusion Network, and what the Faith Inclusion Network does is train and support churches and faith communities in their efforts to be inclusive for people with disabilities and their families. We can provide resources that faith communities need. We can connect them with consultants. Also, you know, we can go out and do some training and consultations when people are considering starting a special needs ministry or a disability ministry. So those are the things that the Faith Inclusion Network can offer. A lot of what we do is just provide connections. You know, we can connect churches with other churches that are actually doing a disability ministry so that, you know, they have some, they can kind of network a little bit and share ideas.
So what are some of the common resources that people request in starting up a disabilities ministry?
You know, a lot of times people are not sure how to go about doing it. And many want to, but they just don't know how. And they don't know where to look. And so, with our resources that we offer, again, we offer connections to these resources. You know, we can connect them with books such as Longing for Belonging. So we can connect them with other types of materials that focus on the practical things like accessibility, volunteer handbooks, and volunteer do's and don'ts. A lot of what we start with is understanding what inclusion is and how inclusion needs to be more than just a program, but it's really a way of life for the whole church that really includes all of the church's programs.
So, what are some of the benefits to a parishioner with a disability in actually being included as part of the faith community?
You know, the most obvious thing, and I think may be overlooked, is their faith life. To be included, and so many times people have not been included and been excluded from churches. The spiritual needs that each person has can be met by churches that are welcoming and accepting. And, you know, those are your fellowship needs. I think that's one of the bigger benefits is being part of a church or a faith family. And, you know, aside from that, belonging to a church or a faith family and then belonging to God. Those are the two basic needs I think that we all have, and some of the benefits for people with disabilities who don't have those. I think sometimes we take that for granted, and it's much more difficult for a person with a disability to find that fellowship with congregation and that fellowship with God.
So, in your time with Disabilities in Ministry and Faith Inclusion Network, has there been any success moment that stands out for you, where you were able to provide an especially meaningful connection, maybe?
A couple. We have a couple of churches in my area in West Texas who are trying to start disability ministries and have some ideas and just are not sure about how to go about it. And so one of the things we've been able to do is connect them with some trainings that can give them some answers to some specifics of how to plan and organize a disability ministry. This one church has great ideas of things that they want to do, but they're just a little uncertain. And so, because a lot of the disability ministries are done by moms or one or two people in a church, and so it's done in isolation. And one of the big benefits, and we found this through churches in Norfolk, Virginia, that have utilized SHARE, one of the big benefits is knowing that you're not alone and that there are other people doing this work in the community and that there are other people that can share ideas and their struggles and failures and successes. And so that means a whole lot to... And I've heard that over and over again. That means a whole lot to these churches and the faith leaders. And I say churches, but the Faith Inclusion Network is interfaith, so it's not just for Christian churches, but we support other inclusion efforts in the Jewish faith and Muslim faith as well. But the fact that they know that they're not alone, that there are others doing this work, and that there are a lot of resources that they can rely on. And so just those types of connections are just extremely important, and it gives people working in an individual faith community, it gives them the courage they need, and it gives them support that they need to know that they're just not alone in trying to develop these and that there are people out there that can help.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Whether you're on the go or staying home, make CJAM the soundtrack to your day. Tune into 99.1 FM on your radio or visit cjam.ca to listen live or access past shows. You can also stream us right from iHeartRadio. Just visit iHeartRadio.ca or download the iHeartRadio app. And if you feel like it, connect with us on social media. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all at CJAM FM. Keep yourself close to the music. CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching higher ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about cavernous malformations from Prem Kaur and Kaylee Alig, and Tom Jones told us a little bit about his disability ministry efforts. In this segment of our show, Megan Hines will be giving us an update on her power hockey work. So what's the latest with power hockey?
It's been exciting. We have an event coming up, actually, on March 2nd. It's called the World of Hockey, and it's going to be basic scoring, kind of the diversity in the game. So we have about 5 different sessions. It'll be a virtual event, so if anyone wants to check it out, they can go to worldofhockey.ca to learn more. We have some exciting speakers. One session is called Idea to Execution. They're talking about, best practices about starting new leagues or new programs, and we have some, representation from all different types of hockey. Another session is about kind of the player perspective, looking at transitioning from recreational to high-performance athletes, how to manage that transition, what does that transition mean, how to kind of, compete in the high-performance level, that kind of thing. And then on the flip side, we have the same kind of session from the management and coaching perspective, how to support high-performance athletes, and make sure that, what else do they look at, not just kind of pure skill, but, the leadership qualities and mental health and mental wellness and overall culture of the team. And then kind of our final session of the day is also looking at the kind of overall diversity in hockey and how do we really grow the game of hockey and make sure it remains inclusive and diverse for everyone. And like I mentioned, it's really about bringing the broader hockey community together. So we have representatives from all different types, from blind hockey, deaf hockey, ice hockey, sledge hockey, or now known as para ice hockey, all different kinds. Talk about, while they may be, different types of hockey, there are definitely some, similarities across all the sports. So it's going to be really cool to bring together the broader hockey community and for this great discussion.
So I'd imagine that even with the diverse types of hockey players you're bringing together, some of the benefits are universal. Being a part of a team for anyone with a disability or even without is good for mental wellness and such.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, we all talk about how, there's certainly benefits of being involved in, sport and physical activity and, that kind of thing. But so many of the benefits kind of are really beyond the sport itself. There's community that creates around hockey, the peer mentorship aspect, all the different ways that people can get involved, leadership qualities, and different, skills that people develop that they use on the floor or on the ice and that they use off the ice. For instance, for myself growing up in power hockey, I was really able to develop, again, those leadership qualities that, analytical thinking, problem solving, all those things that I use, when I'm playing, but also in my employment and in my education kind of thing. So it's really cool to, and exactly like you said, kind of talking about how that's very similar across no matter what kind of hockey or sport you're playing.
So I'm kind of curious about one of your earlier points about transitioning from recreational to high performance. What are some of the key differences and similarities in making that transition?
Yeah, I think it's definitely an interesting one, especially across different types of sport or hockey. For some, playing and moving into that transition, that's their full-time job. But for many, where there may not be the, financial aspect of playing a sport at that high-performance level or, other aspects, if they may be having to manage working full-time or going to school full-time and also, being a high-performance athlete. And so it's really about how you manage that transition and how you, there's so much pressure at that level kind of thing to, be at the top and stay at your top of your game. And so one thing we're going to be talking about, we have a couple of interesting speakers, or a lot of interesting speakers, but for this one we have, Erin Ambrose. She's part of the new PWHL, the Montreal team. We also have Tyler McGregor. He is team captain for Team Canada for para ice hockey. And then also Matt Smith, who is part of Floorball Canada and Team Canada and captain of that team as well. And so they'll all be talking about kind of their, transition and how they really manage that and how they manage, sometimes you may not get selected for those teams at first and how you really, work through that adversity and how you, continue to work hard and bring your whole self so you can, be recognized and be maybe selected for the next time. So, there's a lot that definitely comes into play when managing that transition.
So I take it you're going to include things like talking about the challenges and keeping focused on the game. Can't be an easy sport to learn, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, in terms of how to, like you said, keep focused and how to, you know, really kind of manage that within, you know, your day-to-day, like how do you achieve that balance and everything. So that's definitely a lot of things that the panel will touch on for sure.
One thing I've always found interesting is those who are just entering into a recent disability or injury situation, a lot of them can use sport as a means of both physical and psychological healing. Do you ever find that to be the case with power hockey?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, with power hockey for sure. Especially, you know, maybe it's about kind of an acquired disability and so on, managing that transition. And like I said, you know, the peer mentorship asset, you know, seeing other players and learning from them and saying, hey, like, you know, you're living independently, you have attendant care, how do I do that kind of thing? Sometimes, like, those just informal chats off the floor, a lot of people value and kind of really learn a lot from. But it could also be, you know, sometimes managing the transition of maybe, you know, someone had the strength of using a manual chair or maybe walking with crutches or whatever the assistive device may be. And maybe, you know, their disability progressed and they need to manage to now, you know, use a wheelchair full-time or use a power wheelchair full-time. So there's also that aspect of kind of sometimes progressive disabilities or just changing disabilities. You know, we all age and, you know, things happen. So the body changes. And so how do you, you know, learn from others on the floor as well in terms of how to stay at the top of your game kind of thing? It could be existing para athletes and power hockey players or new ones as well, and kind of just chatting through it and really kind of getting that peer support.
So do you find that the community as a whole is typically responsive when you talk about para hockey or power hockey as a sport?
Yeah, I think when I raise awareness about power hockey, I think, like I mentioned previous, probably on one of these podcast episodes, the, you know, sport of power hockey, there's still a lot of work to be done to really get it kind of that name recognition, because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the sport exists kind of thing. But, you know, once they hear the sport, when they see the sport in action, you know, people are really, you know, excited about how it is an intense sport, how it is really competitive, how it's like an outlet for people to get, you know, physical activity and really in that team environment kind of thing. So, yeah, as soon as people, you know, see it, they, you know, maybe I'm a bit biased, but people tend to kind of fall in love with it like I do kind of thing and either want to get involved as a player or as a coach or volunteer or just a fan as well and see what they can do to support. So it's really been great, kind of the reception that we've been getting over the years.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Megan was absolutely right, my friends. In disability life, one of the core principles is always carry your strengths forward. What you learn as part of a team or just exploring your own capabilities, something that doesn't just affect you when you're out there playing your game or in a school setting or what have you. You find that those strengths are a part of you in all that you do. Especially when dealing with an acquired injury, you might ask the questions, can I still do what I love to do? Is there still a way for me to live a full, rich life? And I maintain the answer is always yes. People who are determined enough, supported enough, wise enough to recognize that they do have potentials will always succeed. The truth is, it can be hard finding the right adaptation. Disability is not a one-size-fits-all. Not every person is meant to do everything, but you can always find a way to at least ask, what can be done to modify the things I love, and what can I still do in the same way, for that matter? People are stronger and more creative than we often give them credit for, and really, carrying the strength you learn in one aspect of your life into all others can make you a much more well-rounded person. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.